Thank you all, as always, for coming, and thank you to Young Israel for hosting the Summer Beit Midrash. So last summer, the 2014 Summer Beit Midrash, the subtitle was, Is There a Right to Religious Experience? And I spent the summer with varying degrees of success trying to convince the fellows that this was a legitimate question to start with, and then to give them something of a bias toward an answer. So what I want to do tonight is begin with something of a philosophic intro about why this might or might not be a good question. And then what I want to do is take you through two texts, and to some degree inside a conversation that I've had both privately and publicly with Rabbi Dov Linzer. If you were here at his, I brought him in last year to talk about this here, and then we had a public conversation that you can watch on YouTube about the meaning of a particular text and whether the proper framing for that text is around the question of a right to religious experience. So the first thing to talk about is about the notion of a right. Because one of the tropes that I think people like to teach is that Judaism is a religion of duties and not obligations, and not a religion of rights. So the notion of talking about rights automatically frames you as thinking about something in a in an American context as opposed to in a Jewish context. So I want to just lay that on the table first of all. Right? Is there a basis in Judaism for thinking about a conception of right as opposed to a conception of duty? Now, the other issue about a conception of right as opposed to of rights as opposed to duties is the other argument is to claim that it's a silly question, because the rights and duties are just the same thing, right? If I have a duty towards you, then you have a right to expect that from me. Now, I first learned from a marvelous book that I recommend at every opportunity I can, by Benjamin Friedman, called Duty and Healing, that there are circumstances in which whether you use right language or duty language makes a genuine difference. So Friedman argues that in the context of medical ethics, that in a rights-based system, what will happen in a complicated medical case is that people will argue about who gets to make the decision, whereas if they have a duty-based culture, they will argue about what the right thing to do is. And in a right-based conversation, people's interests are in conflict, whereas in a duty-based conversation, everyone has the same interests. Right? That was really the first time that I was convinced that there really was a difference between rights and duties. But it's one that Friedman argues should bias us again towards duty. He thinks it's what halachic thinking, really the first thing halachic duty has to add to contemporary conversations, is that people should stop thinking about what they have a right to do and start thinking about what the right thing to do is. So on the one hand, that biases me towards duties. On the other hand, it opens up a space for a distinction between rights and duties. So I want to move it into a slightly different space. I brought Rabbi Howard Jachter, Rabbi Chaim Jachter, up last year. I bring him up every year. He'll be here in a couple of weeks as well. And I asked him what he would talk about in the realm of the question of, is there a right to religious experience? And he came up with a fascinating case. And he argued that there are occasions in which people have a right to be converted. And I want to put that out there. Right? You know, it's clear, right, that you can say, well, do they have a right to be converted, or do we have a duty to convert them? But I think that we can understand intuitively that there's a difference in the way you frame it. Right? Whether you say this person has a right to convert, or you say that those people have an obligation to convert the person. And his argument, which he attributed to Rabbi Soloveitchik, but I'm not going to tell you whether that was a compelling attribution or not, Rabbi Jachter attributed to Rabbi Soloveitchik, is that when a non-Jewish person reaches the stage in which they have done everything that is necessary to be converted, right, to be converted lichatchila in an Orthodox setting, they have a right to be converted. And if a Beit Din fails to convert them, it is not only is it failing in its own duty, but that's not really the way of framing. What it's doing is infringing on the other person's right to be Jewish. And what that really means is they're infringing on their right to have Jewish religious experiences. Okay, yes, sir.
Can you please offer a precise definition of right and duty?
Not really, no. Not really, other than, you know, if defining in other words will just give other words. You know, I could say entitlement as opposed to obligation. Now I have more words. And we could keep on adding words around that. So I'm going to work fundamentally with the notion that you have intuitive conceptions in your head that my words are tapping into, as opposed to trying to offer. At the end of the shiur, we can ask again and come up with a. In this case, do we say that not that this person should be converted, but this person can demand of us that we convert them. Right, and say that if you fail to convert me. Right, then you right. There is something I should have, and the same way, you know, we can argue again. Do you have a right to personal property? Right, do you have a right to your salary? But maybe the best way to say you have a right to your salary. Right, I could say the other person owes you your salary. Right, but it's something. But we can always flip it that way. Right, rights generally create corresponding duties. Not always. I'll get to throw in one of my fun, you know, tangential words I enjoy, that I argue. That the Rambam in the Mishneh Torah, as opposed to the Rambam in the Perush of Mishnayot, says that the king has a right to command you, but I believe the Rambam says that you have no obligation to obey the king. He has a right to command, you have no obligation to obey. If you disobey, he has a right to enforce his commands. You have a right to resist his enforcement. Usually he'll have more power than you will, so he will win. Right. It's possible that if you know that the king is prepared to utilize extreme force, so then you have an obligation to obey out of self-preservation. But it's not like, but it's not that there's an absolute religious duty of obedience. Right? What there is a right of command. And Rabbi J. David Blech, my teacher, taught me that the formal phrase for this is a right without a corresponding obligation. He disagreed vociferously with my reading. But gave me the language, which was very nice of him. So we might even say that such a person has a right to convert, but there is no corresponding obligation because there's no body in which that obligation could specifically adhere. But I want to just put out that notion, which Rabbi Jachter put out. It's a really fascinating idea that there's a time when we say that this person has a right to be converted. And he's not framing it, as we might argue now, that he's not framing it in terms of a disjunction between their social position and their religious position, which is a big issue in conversion now, where if somebody's always had a Jewish identity, right? So we say they have a right to be converted because they have a right to psychological identity wholeness, issues like that. Just flat out, this person has done everything that they need to do to deserve conversion. And so, so they have a right to be converted. So I'm not sure, you know, that I go as far as Rabbi Jachter does. I push him on that, but I was fascinated by the notion of that argument. That you could have a right, because what would generate that? What would it mean? Right? Why would you have such a right? Yes?
Yeah. A few reasons.
Yeah.
One way to put maybe to get your question, rights and obligations are things that are agreed upon by parties. A treaty, or you come to a business agreement,
mm-hmm.
and you jointly agree, you know, I will work for you for 8 hours doing this and that, and you will then, you know, pay me $10 or whatever. So we have an agreement, and it's certain, we call them rights and obligations, two sides of the same. So that can bring a little bit of structure to it. But I think there's also a distinction between when I want to do something on my own, I want to sit down, stand up, whatever, that involves no action on your part, no positive action, versus when I want to do something that does, in order to complete that act, does require some action on your part, as I would like to be converted, but I am not a Beit Din, I can't do it myself, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a rabbi. So I need you to fulfill this desire, call it right, whatever. Those are very different things. So it's one thing to say, I'm allowed to do this, and you really you may have the power, but you don't have you're not correct if you try and stop me from doing it. another thing to say, I'm allowed to do this, and you must do it. You must make it happen.
So does it make sense to you that somebody could say to you, you must make it possible for me to convert?
Sure, we see it now with gay marriage, right? Just these past few weeks, where the Supreme Court says, okay, male, female, doesn't matter, folks want to get married, and certain judges say, well, that's fine that you have that right, but you can't make me officiate at a wedding.
And that case is obviously being kind of controversial, but let's say in the narrow case of conversion, does it make sense to you for somebody to be able to walk up to a Beit Din and say, I have done everything that I should do, and the fact that I have done everything that I should do, and that I am this kind of person, means,
I think essentially to say that,
yeah,
you would first have to have established some agreement, some legal standard by which the individual and the Beit Din must act.
So it has to be a legal standard. So that's interesting because
I use the word legal
loosely. So that's an interesting question about whether it functions legally or just spiritually. There are two tensions here. One is, and where Rabbi Schachter is coming from, is that if you look at the language of the Gemara and the Shulchan Aruch, when a person achieves a certain bar, the statement is, you accept them immediately, and you circumcise them immediately, and you immerse them immediately. And the language of immediately seems to suggest that delay is an infringement. On the other hand, the demand is impossible, because one of the things, when you ask the proper answer for a convert, when they've explained everything to them, is, yes, I know that I am unworthy of this. And therefore, demanding it might be a... it might be a catch-22 that you can only exercise your right by.
That may be true, but what you've established here is a legal standard, which is the Gemara, right?
Ah, okay. So you can say according to the Gemara, right?
That we can debate whether the Gemara says A or whether the Gemara says B, but your assumption here is that we're all accepting the authority of the Gemara, and as long as we agree on what it says, then we know what to do.
Okay, but the interesting question is, why did the Gemara say it? Right? Where did the Gemara get this idea I have to do it? Yes, David?
So, when you talk about someone converting,
yeah,
there's the mitzvah set, right?
Of what?
So, any mitzvah set. Right?
Conversion?
Jews are responsible for doing mitzvahs to say.
Yeah.
And if you have this person who goes through this whole process, and they're there, and they've fulfilled everything, so they have the right to convert in their mind, or if they've gone through the process.
Yeah.
Then by not converting them, you're not allowing them to do the mitzvot.
That's yes, you're not allowing them to do a mitzvot. So do I have, but they're not obligated yet, right? If they were already obligated, so you could say that I have an I have a duty generated by their obligation. The question is, do I have a duty to enable them to be obligated?
Well, but I'm saying if they fulfill those requirements,
yeah,
are they now obligated to do the mitzvot? I'm saying, are you
no.
to help them?
They're not obligated until they convert. And there's never an obligation to convert. Right? The only thing you can get it is a right. Right? There's never an obligation to convert.
No, yeah. I understand that, but I'm trying to say that if they want to convert, obviously.
Right.
They've gone through this whole process, they've done everything you've asked them to do.
Uh-huh.
They're right there.
Right.
They're ready to convert.
Yeah.
And if the Beit Din believes that they're ready to convert, I don't know what's holding them from doing it. If they believe they're ready, then I would think that they...
Maybe the Beit Din thinks, right? And I would say Beit Din is an immigration court, and maybe we think that we don't have the capacity to assimilate someone else for now. Maybe we're just looking at it and saying, you know what? They could convert, but there'll be a drain on our communal resources because they have all sorts of psychological issues that will eat up the rabbi's time. And if I convert them and they live in this community, then I will take less time, right? Everyone will have less time available. Maybe they've done what they can religiously, but they have evident disabilities that will disrupt the community. Maybe they're Republicans or Democrats, depending on which shul you're in. And we figure that there are all sorts of reasons.
Right, so that's what I'm saying. If it's a reason that's outside of it, if you said that they weren't ready, they didn't learn enough, they haven't studied enough, they haven't put enough effort, that sounds reasonable.
Then rights would be irrelevant.
If you say it's not that, they've actually fulfilled everything. They're right there. We all agree. The Beit Din agrees that they're going to be very good Jews. We convert this person, and they're going to be Shomer Mitzvot and everything we could ever want. And I think you do have it. That's what I'm trying to say. There's a mitzvah right there waiting for that person to be able to do it, and you're not allowing them to do it.
But what mitzvah? There's only a mitzvah once we convert them.
I understand.
So that's exactly the point.
If they're right there,
yeah.
And I'm saying that they're on the cusp of it, then I believe it is.
Okay, good. So that's exactly the transition I want, right? You're moving from they have a mitzvah that they are obligated in, I have to help them, to there's a mitzvah they could be obligated in, and I have to help them.
If they fulfilled all the requirements.
Yes.
I mean, that's the key. Right?
They fulfilled all the requirements, but that still hasn't generated the obligation. All right. So that move, to say that people have fulfilled all the requirements, have a right to become obligated. All right. That's an enormous move. That's what Rabbi Schachter tries to argue, and it has practical implications, which he argued is that, you know, there are practical things. Let's say somebody's ready to go to mikveh tomorrow, but it will be really inconvenient for me to go into Brighton. It's very real cases. You know, it happens this week, right? Where I'm running a program full time. There's somebody ready to be converted. I could go into Brighton this week. We found someone else happily. But do I have an obligation to go in? Because they have a right to be converted as soon as they're ready, and not to wait on my convenience. And I have the same obligation as I would have with other, you know, at least as with other mitzvot. Right, so I think that's it, right? So that you find it intuitively convincing is cool. Right?
I'm still with the question of what does a right mean philosophically, other than the ability to make a claim for exercising that right, which automatically means some sort of an obligation on some sort of a person to...
Yeah, so what I was...
Right. Otherwise, having a right doesn't have any meaning, and having a right doesn't mean I can claim it against anybody. There are different kinds of rights. Right to, but basically a right means, excuse me, a right means being able to demand, to be able to make a claim, which means being able to, that it obligates somebody to do something, otherwise it's not a right.
So I think that there is certainly an element to which that's true, but I think that we can intuitively distinguish between an obligation that someone else has towards me, which is not generated by me but generated from their part, which say halachically is a din in the mechuyav, a din in the person who is obligated, not a din in the person towards whom they are obligated, and also the interesting question whether you can have rights vis-a-vis God, right? Whether you can demand that God. That God provide you with certain things, and the way in which that plays out, and that's I think the transition I want to move to is there a basis for making a halachic argument on the grounds that if you were to rule the halacha this way, that would be an infringement of a human right, whereas if you rule the halacha that way, then the halacha is in accordance with the human rights. So you have these a priori self-evident notions that under certain circumstances human beings are entitled, right, have rights to certain things, and so if you, right, as opposed to saying that the rights are constructed by the halacha, which is one vision, right, that all rights are constructed by the halacha, can you have a conception of rights that pre-exist halacha, and that you can judge halachic decisions by whether or not they accord with that conception of rights in the same way that we can judge American law by whether or not it accords with either, and if you're, this is a whole controversy, either with the Constitution, which is easy, because that's a legal document, but the more interesting question is more Clarence Thomas jurisprudence, right? Can you judge halacha, can you judge American law by whether it accords with natural rights, and can, right, and can you judge it by whether it accords with the Declaration of Independence?
Israeli Supreme Court justice who was from made a very interesting statement which had to do with this, but it sort of takes it in a different direction than the way that you're taking, which is it had to do with the famous case of where in Baba Batra, where it mentions where they threw out Rabbi Yirmiyah. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah,
case?
Sure. And this is Justice Alone or somebody else?
Well, Justice Alone. Are you familiar with what his statement was?
I don't know the same that you're quoting off.
Okay, well, it had to do with Rabbi Yirmiyah, who was thrown out of the paper. That Mara says, because he asked the question when it said that if a dove is found 25 amot close to a dove cart, then it belongs to that guy. And Rabbi Yirmiyah asked, suppose it was found 1 foot on one side and 25 on the other foot on the other side. And so they threw him out. And he explains this whole thing by stating America. comes to resolve conflicts between people so that instead of fighting, they should resort to a court of law. So somebody comes to a court of law and he says, that dog is mine. And the other guy says, no, it's mine, I want it. And the guy says, no, it's mine, I want it. And then law comes to state to try and find out whose one it really is so that you can give it to him. I suppose for that, law in halacha comes to say, what is the right thing to do?
All right, so that's the same kind of thing I said in medical ethics, that, right, the halacha
presupposes that when they find the dove, this one says, I found the dove, what's the right thing to do? And the other one says, I have a dove got nearby, is it born or not, what's the right thing to do? And therefore, that's how he explains as regards Rabbi Yehuda.
All right, so that's the same thing I said about Friedman.
They lost that dove, they want to find it out, and so they want to know what's the right thing to do, and the halacha is 25.
Okay, so there are many, many things we could talk about that. I have other times I could talk.
But a right, I'm stating, is, the thing is, a right in itself is like saying, hey, someone's on the right. What does it mean? What does it mean he's on the right? He's the right of somebody or something. To say that you have a right means you have, you can claim against somebody else under certain circumstances. What are the circumstances? Who's the person that you can? Is what?
Okay, so I'm willing to concede that, but I'm interested in the cases whether the people against which who you can generate an obligation for who you're right are the decisors of the law. And you can claim right. You know, the question is, are there rights that precede the law, so that I can say to a halachic posek, right, that you, that I have a right and you have an obligation to decide the law in such a way that that is consistent with my right. That would be another way of formulating if you need to do it in that framework. Mm-hmm. There was another hand up, wasn't there, Alan? Yes.
Well, this isn't one with the decisor. I was trying to think of examples. It's not with the decisor of law. We're wondering, we got to read someone's drowning.
Uh huh.
Do they have a right to be saved? And does that, if they do, does that right depend upon whether or not there's someone passing by who could save them?
So I don't know that they have a right to be saved, as opposed to that you have an obligation to save them. Right? We could frame, you know, I think those are the questions which will always be tautologous. But those are rights constructed by the law. Right? The question is whether they could, right? Whether if they came to a posek, could you, even then, they could, that could be a whether the posek gets it right or wrong. That would be more the posek gets it right. So I'm not sure that that'll work in those circumstances. Takes work to think about whether that kind of case will work.
So some kind of right to life, that does not be the kind of right that
well, a right to life is
halakha?
Right. So you can say that a halakha that allows people to exempt themselves from obligation to save, right, under certain circumstances would infringe on someone else's right to life, right? You know, if you, right, the question is, could you test a halakha and say that halakha is inconsistent with my notion of a right to life? I would tend to think not, because I think the halakha actually is much more constructed around an obligation to save than a right to life. I'm not sure I would construct a right to life halachically. The usual locus, which we've talked about, which I don't want to talk about tonight, is whether there's such a notion as ownership over your body, and whether there are rights in here about that. Okay, I want to set this up, and let's say that the useful formulation about it is this notion of a right that precedes the halakha, as opposed to that is constructed by halacha, is that a religiously coherent concept? So what I want to do first is read a text that I do think seems to work with that concept, and then I'll let you critique it. Right? I'll make the case that this text embodies a concept like that, and then I will read a second text, a much longer involved halachic text, and I'll explain to you in advance what Rabbi Linzer argued this text was about and what I argue this text is about, and you can decide which of these readings, if either of them is compelling. So the first text we're going to do is...
Did you want this first text to demonstrate that there's an obligation to devise a law in accord with the right? Or?
I want to argue that it is a religiously coherent notion to talk about a right to religious experience, and that you can evaluate what the law should be by its coherence with that concept, among others, not the only value, as opposed to saying that there are no rights to religious experience. A religious experience is one that is constructed by the law. Okay, this is connected to the broader question of whether all religious experience is constructed by halakha, right? We might call the extreme Lithuanian position, or whether religious experience is something that is a factual phenomenon. People have, right, a psychological phenomenon, a metaphysical phenomenon. I had a religious experience, and the law can choose to evaluate that as it wishes. But you can't tell me I didn't have a religious experience because you didn't make it, right? Because you didn't construct the law that way. That's related to that question. Yeah.
You're using religious experience in what sense? Just as participating in a ritual or participating in halakha or something more like psychological?
I'm trying to use it as having, I guess if I were trying to use it, I would want to use it in a, I guess, an objective metaphysical sense. I have some kind of experience of God.
It's a very complicated claim.
Yes.
Okay.
Entirely modet, this is a very complicated claim, and I'm happy if you all go home and do the rigorous philosophic homework, because I'm trying tonight to talk mostly as halachists. Although I think that there are extensive articles that can be written trying to do the philosophy more rigorously. Okay, so here's Tosfot. So Tosfot is relating to a machloket in the Mishnah and Megillah, which talks about under what circumstances blind people can play roles in public ritual. And the Mishnah gives a list of things that blind people can do, which includes being pares al Shema. They can be the public leader of the Shema in shul. Separate question why that involves any has any halachic requirements at all, since we don't actually, right, the way Ashkenazim run Shema now, there really is no role for the Chazan at all. But the way Sfardim ran it, and the way it was tied in the Mishnah, the person who read the Shema was really reading the brachot on behalf of everybody. So the question is, could you be pares al Shema? The Mishnah says yes, but then Rabbi Yehuda comes along and he says, Mishlo ra'ab me'orot miyamav. Somebody who has never seen the luminaries, lo yifros al Shema. Such a person is not allowed to be the leader of the Shema. And the rationale for this appears to be that the first bracha of Shema is a bracha on the experience of seeing the sun, Yotzer HaMeorot, God who created the luminaries. And so if you have never actually seen the luminaries, so how can you make that bracha? Okay, that's a very complicated claim. Why should you have to have seen it? Can't you know they exist? Well, let's take that as a given. All right, Rabbi Yehuda's position is that if you have never seen them, right, then you cannot lead them. So Tosfot says, Kashe. It's difficult for us that Rabbi Yehuda specifically would take this position, because Rabbi Yehuda himself says in Bavakama 87a that a blind person is exempt from all commandments. The Gemara in Bavakama goes through a whole question. It has an exemption of blind people from all mitzvot. The question is, does all mitzvot include does that mean a limited set of all mitzvot? We used to say in the YU library there are lots of people who know everything, but they know different everythings. They're non-overlapping infinite sets, or non-congruent infinite sets. So, for example, right, most people end up thinking that it's not okay for blind people to murder people, and that when you're exempt from all commandments, it doesn't include the negative commandments. Most people say that, but not everybody. Let's assume that it just means from all positive commandments. But the problem we have here is, so Rabbi Yehuda takes the position, and this itself is a Tannaitic machloket. Rabbi Yehuda takes the position that blind people are exempt from all positive mitzvot. That being said, Tosfot says, we should not need Rabbi Yehuda. Rabbi Yehuda should not believe this only about somebody who has been blind from birth and never seen the sun and moon. Even if they became blind, having seen the sun, right, having gone out and stared at the moon and held at it for all we know, every night for years, if they can't see it now, they're not obligated now. And how can you make a bracha and fulfill the mitzvah of Kriyat Shema on behalf of other people if you are not commanded? So it tells us that there's a contradiction within Rabbi Yehuda, because this statement seems to believe that this statement here, by implication, says that people who become blind later in life are entitled to make the bracha of Kriyat Shema on behalf of others, whereas this statement suggests that exclusion applies only if they have always been blind and never had the experience. So Tosfos says that the Rishalmi has a nice way out, and it's when we say that somebody's never seen the luminaries, they've never seen the sun, moon, and stars, What that means is that they were born underground and have always lived underground and have never had, and even though they are perfectly capable of seeing, but they have never actually seen the sky. Pardon? Yes, they're born in debtor's prison or the boy in the glass cage, whatever it is. Okay, that seems a sort of radical understanding of what, on its surface, is not a purely theoretical statement in the Mishnah. But that's the way the Yerushalmi, plays it out. But then Tosfos says, we can also say that no, Rabbi Yehuda is talking about an actual blind person, and when Rabbi Yehuda exempted a blind person over there, when Rabbi Yehuda in Bava Kamma said that blind people are exempt from all positive commandments, he meant they are exempt biblically, they're exempt deoraita. But he concedes that they are obligated derabbanan. Okay, so that's a nice solution. Right, blind people are, right, this Mishnah is talking about a mitzvah derabbanan. So blind, right? So here, ordinary blind people, people who became blind after birth, would be obligated. It's a very nice, classic Tosafistic resolution. This is talking about this case. This is talking about that case. But how does he know? Right? We have it. Right? The Talmudic statement says, Rabbi Huda says that blind people are exempt from all, let's say, positive commandments. And now Tosa comes along and says, no, they're not actually exempt from all positive commandments. They're only exempt biblically from all positive commandments. But everything that we exempted them from biblically, we then go right back and we obligate them rabbinically. Now, Tosafot says this as a reconstruction of a position of Rabbi Yehuda. Right? And the only evidence he offers for it initially is that there seems to be a contradiction between the two positions of Rabbi Yehuda, even though he's aware that there is a tradition, the Yerushalmi, which offers an alternative resolution to that contradiction. So he invents a new resolution. What's the basis for that invention? So he goes on and he says, even if he was blind from birth, he is nevertheless obligated midrabanan, so that he should not be as a Gentile, and the Jewish religion not apply to him at all.
And apply the mitzvot.
Well, so they're right. So then Tosafot gets complicated, and this is why this is, in the current era, a somewhat risky shiur to give in public, because people immediately say, "So right, really? Right? If you don't do mitzvot, if you're not obligated in some mitzvot, but not all mitzvot, right? That doesn't work." And then you immediately move to gender, which Tosafot does. Right? Tosafot's next line, he says, "Oh, what about women? No, women are obligated in most mitzvot asay, just not mitzvot asay shas mangrama." He doesn't see that as generating the same issue. Right, we can certainly have that conversation, and I will say for myself that I find the argument of this form entirely compelling with regard to Talmud Torah. Right, and that's part of why I am so deeply committed to women's education in Torah, because that seems to me like how could you not be connected to Torah, right? How could that be a plausible religious position? That is, the equivalent of what the Gemara says the Romans said to the Jews, right? That you're obligated right down for some reason on the horn of an ox, right? I have no share in the Torah of Israel. If you're disconnected to the experience of Talmud Torah, but within the world of Tosafot, what he says here, it seems to me, is that he's arguing that there's a dispute about whether blind people are obligated or not. One position, let's assume that this is an entirely naive biblical reading. Today we're just trying to figure out, what does the Torah say? And one person says, well, it seems to me the Torah says blind people are obligated. And the next person says, no, it seems to me that blind people are exempt. And then we look at it and we say, but that's impossible. How could blind people be exempt? And so we construct a religious experience for them. We say, you are upright, we will generate a rabbinic obligation. Not to protect the biblical obligation, as we do sometimes, not because there's a socially useful purpose, but because how could you not have Jewish religious experience? How could there be somebody who is Jewish and does not have Jewish religious experience? That's impossible. And so we create law. Not even a question of interpreting law. Tosafot interprets the precedent and claims that the proper interpretation of the precedent is that we should create the law, right? That one of the rabbinic powers is the capacity to generate obligation. And we generate this obligation for these people. And my argument is Because they have a right to religious experience. Right. They're Jews, they happen to be blind. Blindness does not remove, right, does not make them people who don't have a right to religious experience. If the law, as is, according to that position, does not provide that for them, then we will construct it for them. Yes, Elliot?
So I agree with your reading completely of Tosfot, but I think Tosfot's reading is way off, just for the simple reason, if this is about me doing a banan, then I won't need to be told even that ain't posi na lashma, that they can't leave shma, because if they have a different obligation than the rest of the kahal, of course they can't.
No, so we're talking about shema in the context of tefillah, which is only drabanan. Right, we parse that. Tosfot solves that problem.
Okay.
Right, he knows that problem full well, and okay. He thinks it's only drabanan. Right, he's not right. That it's not the next stage. Is not this is ridiculous.
Okay.
All right, that's clear. Yes, Alan.
Why do you think we're talking about the person instead of the system? I mean, it seems to be arguing that the system just doesn't make sense if they have no.
What system doesn't make sense?
Judaism.
Why not? They're blind.
Because you just made this argument that it's absurd. We say it's absurd that someone could be Jewish and yet not have.
Why? Why should they be obligated? The law says they're not. The law is what the law is. We read the Torah. The Torah said they're not obligated. So we discover that we might have thought that that being Jewish means you have all sorts of obligations. No. Some people are Jewish and they don't have those kinds of obligations. What's the problem with that? Yeah, they don't have mitzvot aseh. Why would we assume that they should have mitzvot aseh? So the answer is, right, there has to be some a priori notion, right, that they have. Now, I am trying to interpret that in light of religious experience. You could try and interpret it socially, I guess, if you wanted instead. But that's right. But to me, this is a very powerful moment when someone just constructs a whole set of obligations because can't imagine how could there be these people and not be obligated. How could that be? Yes, Janet.
So we're saying that if one is not obligated, then one cannot have a religious experience.
Ah, very good. Right, very good. So, if we say that religious experience exists outside the law. Why should it matter, right? Why should it matter? So here I have to make a much sharper point. This would be even more work for philosophers. Right? There is, right? So I hinted this before. What I want to argue, really, is under some circumstances, there is a right to be obligated.
That's right.
I want to argue that there is that part of what means to be Jewish. Is to have the experience of acting out of obligation.
But who says that it is your right to it, as opposed to Judaism's obligation to take care of that?
I don't really care whether we say it's your right to have it or Judaism has an obligation to ensure that you allow that. All right, that's okay with me. That's okay with me. I don't need to write it. I don't write it. As long as we can generate the obligation prior to the system, right? I'm okay. I'm okay with that formulation being reversed. Yes.
We feel bad, so we're going to give him this obligation.
So you could say we feel bad. Tosfot doesn't frame it as awe. He frames it as how could it be?
Yeah.
Right.
And for some reason, just in the case of this blind person,
assuming,
I feel really bad. I'm not sure why.
Okay. You could interpret it entirely as sentiment, if you wish.
No, it doesn't have to be sentimental. It could be like kavan habriyot or whatever. And so for some reason, it doesn't need to.
It's
hug. Kavan habriyot is an interesting notion. What generates that? I'm open to other readings. Right? I want to argue that I think the most plausible reading
is that it's a right.
Is that it's a right to religious experience? That's my argument. You know, I can't claim it's a completely rigorous. Compelling argument, but I think it's a pretty good argument. Okay, yes, Ellie.
And how do you argue that halacha is the key to religious experience?
Because religious obligation, so in order for this to work, you have to say that there is a certain kind of experience which is generated by formal legal obligation. I am still acting like a litfak in this way. Right, that there's a difference between that you can have two people can engage in the identical experience with identical motivation, but one of them is mechuyav al pi halacha and one of them is not, and the experience is different. So this ties into the Gemara there talks about with blind people, is it better to be obligated or is it better not to be obligated? Right? So that right. So this works as a notion that at least it's different. At least it's different to be obligated. And that is an experience that you have a right to. You have a right to the experience of doing mitzvot as a mechuyav, as opposed to as a mitnadev. Yes, I'm putting a great deal into Tosfot. Freely conceded, I'm putting a great, great deal into Tosfot.
Religious experience, because Tosfot certainly does not use that term.
Well,
and then his whole expression is the coin. I'm just drawing an analogy now in terms of, like, what the Gemara says as regards something that they decide on. And they said, is it possible that it could be asur to a goy and not asur to us? Or
by prohibitions.
Right, but that it's not a matter of terms. It's more an expression of Tosfot. Can we have a Jew who does not have Jewish obligations?
Right.
And so on. But that does not mean the notion of religious experience.
Okay. Good. So good. So
I'm gonna take
one more comment. Janice, you had a comment too. I'll take two more comments, and then I want to move on to the second part. I'm freely conceding that this is not yet at the level of a rigorous philosophic argument, and that it's not the only way to read Tosfot. What I want to claim is the most plausible way of reading Tosfot, and that based on that, right, you could construct such an argument, but it'll depend on what you consider to be the nature of religious experience, how you relate obligations to religious experience, how you relate halacha to the actual notion of obligation, the difference between mitzvot aseh and lo taseh, whether you think there's such a thing metaphysically as a Jewish soul, all those sorts of things will be implicated in a full, rigorous notion. Okay, yes, Josh and Yish.
Okay, so I think there's more to being Jewish than being mechuyav in the mitzvot.
More.
Yes.
Agreed. There's more. Yes, yes.
I think you're against the Gemara. Rav Sheshes originally thought it was better to not be Mitzuvah, because he wanted to be part of the mitzvahs and do them anyway. So he found that the greater religious experience was, meaning, the Gemara, at least there are going to be some people whose tendency is going to be that the greater religious experience is to not have obligation to do it anyway.
So that is that's an interesting point. So the question here is, right, one way, if we were framing it lumdishly, the question is, that, right, so there's a machloket which is not the same as the machloket between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, right, the machloket about whether it is better to perform a mitzvah, or better to be commanded, or not be commanded, which is the inverse of the Gemara about blindness, right, where Rav Sheshes originally says, apparently believing that he is commanded, he'll give a party for anybody who says he's not. And then he hears Rav Chanina come along and say, it's better to be commanded and do it, not be commanded and do. So he decides that he'll give a party for anyone who says that he is, or that he is commanded, but apparently believing that he's not. And that's a complicated notion. So the question is, whether Tosfot would construct this position, even according to the position that says it's better to not be commanded, or whether Tosfot is constructing this position only in accordance with the notion that it is better to be commanded, and therefore, since it's better to be commanded, right. Because if you think that it's better to not be commanded, so then what argument does he make? How could there be a person who doesn't have dat yehudi? What do you mean? He has all the dat yehudi he wants.
Right. And the Gemara's anecdotal evidence clearly tells us that there's at least one person whose internal inclination was to be more happy about the fact that he wasn't commanded.
And the Yerushalmi holds that way.
But
I think that Tosfot... I think that Tosfot is constructing this according to the reverse, which is the way we hold. And if you really wanted to have fun and put an Achronish Pilpul together, we'd say that Tosfot holds that the Teres of Beit Afel is Lashitaso with the other one, and right, and he rejects both Yerushalmis together. That would be fun.
Yeah, what
would they do with Rav Sheshes? If Rav Sheshes were correct, then he wouldn't need to make this argument. But we pass against Rav Sheshes, so that leaves an impossibility. That you want to say is, why did Rav Sheshes know?
His religious feeling is against what Tosfot is saying.
People ask the argument in reverse, right? If Tosfot is correct, why was Rav Sheshes so happy he could never not be commanded? That's the attack on Tosfot. Since he's mechuyav anyway, right? So what would the party help? The only difference is whether he's mechuyav the right to the Rabbanan. Right? The question goes. I think the question goes on Tosfot that way, not on me. I think. Okay, gotta go to the next thing. Okay, the next thing we're gonna do, only one other text, although it's a long text, and we'll. We're not going to do the whole thing, and what I gave you is slightly under, it's probably about 40% of the original, is a tshuva from the Mas'eit Binyamin. I mean, you have an Aaron Salnik in the 16th century, who I believe is a student of the Rama, somewhere in that universe. This is a tshuva that often gets pulled out for exactly these contexts. I think that Rabbi Helfgott pulled it out first, and then Rabbi Linzer and I have both used it. And it's a sort of unusual tshuva, I should tell you up front, because it is, as opposed to many tshuvot, strive for the appearance of being written stream of consciousness. This is a tshuva which is very, very explicitly structured clearly in advance. He knows exactly what he's going to say. Right? It's an essay. Right? It's not a stream of consciousness report. And it's written, it makes no effort to present itself as dispassionate academic analysis. Now, in some ways, that's valuable, because I think it's important to recognize that a tshuva is not, and necessarily many tshuva are not academic articles, but they are as exercises in persuasive halachic rhetoric. But this tshuva is more explicitly that than most. It starts off, as many tshuvot do, with poetry, but usually the purpose of poetry at the beginning of a tshuva is it's kind of a competition to show, right, whoever writes the best poetry, the coolest illusions, is clearly the bigger Talmid Chacham, and so has more authority. This seems more to be creating a mood. Right? You win absolutely if you you often start with long poems complimenting the person who asked the question, and if you can compliment him with an abbreviation that he doesn't understand, you win. That's absolute victory. Okay, so here is the Masseit Binyamin, and what he says is. And if you look in the Hebrew, I couldn't translate the whole thing. It's a really long thing. But yeah, right. I made it here, right? So you'll see that he rhymes, right? In shlamim v'chein rabim darchu v'avru b'torah v'chusu b'u v'hakora v'chol echad kulei ha'sara sivim od nisara zeh le'tera v'zeh li'sura b'inyanim suma yachol alot v'likrot b'torah. Right? So there's meter and there's rhyme. He's having lots of fun, right? Amaseif lechol machanot. Right now we move off the rhyme, and he tells us what's going on. Amaseif lechol machanot. So the maseif lechol machanot, the one who follows after and collects everything after the camp. This is Sheva Dan in Chumash, right? But he uses it as in right. He uses that as an anthologizer.
Is that a compliment or an
insult? It's a compliment, I think. I think the maseif right. It's the person. Right. He's the person who put everything. Who put everything together, although it treats him, I suppose, as the person whose job is to report other people's positions as opposed to his own. So the Masef the Cholamachanot, Digle Hava, right, who are flying the banners of love, Le'oro Yisu Kolam Kodesh. This is definitely a compliment, right? So this person is the one who sets out the beacon by which the whole nation travels. We're still in the metaphors of the desert. Hagaon Muflag B'doro, the great one who was greater than anybody else's generation. Morenu Harav Yosef Karo B'Sefer HaBeit Yosef Shelo. Right, so Yosef Karo in the Beit Yosef, which was the index cards from which the Shulchan Aruch is eventually written. Liket V'Asaf L'Chol HaDayot. He collected all the positions. V'Shakal V'Arach, and he weighed and measured. Right, he weighed and evaluated. V'Ela L'Isura She'eno Rashay La'alot Beit HaMinuyin. And he ended up with the position is that a blind person cannot get an aliyah. Okay, so the opening of the statement tells you that he's writing in the 16th century, the Shulchan Aruch is sweeping through the world, and Rav Yosef Kara collected all the material, and that's what standard halacha is. Rav Yosef Kara collects the material, he puts it in order, Rav Yosef Kara collected the material, he evaluated, and he ruled that blind people cannot get aliyot.
Even though it's a mitzvah to say.
Absolutely. Even though he ruled that a blind person cannot get an aliyah, even if blind people are obligated to Rabbanan in mitzvot, but there's a special issue about Kriyat HaTorah, which is Kriyat HaTorah involves reading. So the question is, can you give an aliyah to someone who can't read? And Rav Yosef Karo says, a blind person can't read. So how could you possibly give him an aliyah?
Does the same go for someone who just refuses to read? Or just like...
No, but we'll see. The same goes for a person who's illiterate.
That'd be a problem in a lot of schools.
Yeah, so I should say up front, I am the outcome, the Psak Halacha today And so far as I know, very, very broadly, although you can read, I believe, in interesting, you know, the law in the books goes both ways. I think Rabbi Joshua Yoder has a whole story where the question came up in shul, and he remembered what was written in a book, and so he said that you shouldn't, and then he looked up and realized no. The practical halacha is that in most places that blind people get aliyot. I'm not so interested in the practical. Not that they can be the bal kriya, but they can get aliyot. But I'm not interested here in what the halacha is. What I'm interested in is the nature of the argument that he makes. Right? How does he perceive? Right? Do you believe that he is making a dispassionate halachic argument with a result? That's fine. Or is there something else going on? And if that something else is going on, what is the something else going on? So he says, "Vani amarti," but I said. And now he starts quoting biblical verses at you. Right? He says, right, even if the spirit of the ruler goes against you, don't give up, because God, so on. Right, he has fun. Amod avez zenuach, which is Moshe Rabbeinu. Hatorah bekaren zevit munach kol ritzi yaviyitol umisvachel lo yibatel. Now we get to the English. Where we are in English, right? Ki ze ata leit ziknati. For now, in my old age, chashku haraot ba'arubot. Right, the seers in their socket. Raot ba'arubot is those who see in the windows. Right, but it's a metaphor for eyes. Right, so the seers in their sockets are shaded. Chashku, they have grown dark. Vatichena einai meirot, and my eyes have dimmed beyond sight, which is language taken from Yitzchak. Right, because I can't Yitzchak, vatichena einav meirot. Ulefi asher alta machshava shataravzal, and according to what arose in the mind of the Beit Yosef, yigarsheni milistapeach benachalat Hashem. He was expelling me, right? He's a Gershani, he's kicking me out, right, from attachment, from being joined to the homestead of God. V'torah demet chaye olam, and the Torah of truth, and eternal life. How? By not counting me among those who get aliyah. Right? So not giving me an aliyah is essentially kicking me out of Gan Eden. Right? That's the rhetoric. Beit Yosef, by passing this way, is kicking me out of Gan Eden, but I haven't sinned. He might be having lots of fun if you want to read this really quick, right? Because, right, what did Adam and Chava do to get kicked out of Eden? And what happens after they eat from the tree?
Their eyes are opened.
And they see. Right? So his eyes are closing. Right? So how can you kick me out? Right, it's exactly. Right, he might or might not be having that much fun. I'm not sure.
Is he generally ironic?
There really isn't so much. Like, this is really a fairly unique tshuva for him. I was interested, like, because you always write this way, and I read through. I rapidly read through, you know, a random sampling of his tshuva. This is pretty unusual. This is a rhetorical flourish that of a form that he doesn't have in his other tshuva. So I can't really tell you what he was like.
It's all curry, though.
He was a.
He's about Kari.
How do you know that?
It's pretty clear from Chula, I think it's some above. He hasn't said Beferish, but it's pretty clear he's about Kari there.
Interesting.
And he yells at all the Bali Kriya who aren't good at being Bali Kriya.
Aha. But this.
That's a motivating thing.
I think it's part of it.
That's interesting,
it's
psychologically.
This is like really emotional.
Yeah, but this is right. This is right. You don't usually start Shuvah by saying, right, it's about me. Right? It's about me. I am, right, I'm going blind. And I'm looking at the halacha the way I would decide the halacha if anyone else asked me the question. And I'm looking at it saying, oh my goodness, the Beit Yosef is kicking me out of Eden. Yes.
Well, Lisa. As someone who never gets an
aliyah. Yes.
It's an interesting thing for me to hear. And also, there were many times in the life of a man where, when they were children, when there were, you know, people who were ill, whatever, there were, this, I mean, too bad that his eyes are going, but it's an interesting statement that he should be this angry of something that there were many other Jews who are in his situation, and it's just, that's the way it is.
So, yes, absolutely. And I say, you know, you read this, and, you know, it's hard to do this without jumping immediately to gender, which Tosfot at least recognized, and he doesn't.
Other things as well, being a child, you know, there are other.
Sure. Sure. So there are two ways to answer. One is, he's being deprived of something that he's already experienced and has been important to him. The second is you can make it personal and saying it's a physical disability, and now we're adding insult to injury. And for somebody whose life is reading, right, studying Torah, so right, this might he might feel this is his last connection in a certain way. So we can emphasize the additional things, although it's possible. I often say take every opportunity, and my own vision of what blindness in religion means is heavily influenced by Rabbi Yosef Winevsky, Zichrono Livracha, who was a middle-aged rabbi in the YU library, who found out that when he was a younger student in Chaim Berlin, when he was a teenager, he realized he was going blind. And so he dedicated himself to memorizing the whole Talmud and a set of commentaries, especially of Yosef Engel's commentaries, and to memorizing them before he went blind. And then, for the rest of his life, you could go to him, right? And he would always, whatever you were learning a sugya, you could go and ask, what does Rav Yosef Engel say about this? And he would know that. But also, he would sit in the YU library, and Professor Shalom Karmi would read essentially every interesting book that came to the library outside to him. Right? Read it to him, and so he stayed perfectly intellectually current in Torah, because people kept reading to him, and he trained his memory so that he knew a ton more, right? And he learned a ton more after he was blind than I have learned in my life in equivalent period. But that was something that for all of us who were in the library at that time, that was a living example of how people handle that issue, and not giving him an aliyah would have been pretty hard to do. And this ties into gender also, right? Whether the notion of giving aliyah connects to the question of education, and there's a certain point at which you just can't do that. That's an open question. My wife makes that point fairly often. It's not a question of gender; it's a question of kvod haTorah. Eventually, if it isn't already. Okay, the other thing is what? Maybe he picked a bad case. Right? Maybe this isn't such a big deal. And I can certainly sympathize with you. And this is my own thing, which also ties into gender. My wife gets mad at me. So when it comes to the importance of being a shliach tzibur, so I enjoy being a shliach tzibur. But when I was 14 or 15 or something like that, I got into a giant fight with one of my best friends over who would get to lead a particular hakafa on Simchas Torah. And I went home, and I said to myself, wow, that's really not right. And then I didn't serve as a shliach tzibur again, until I started going out with Deborah, right, who asked me to. Because I just said, this is not, obviously I'm not doing this for the right reason. I'm not doing it for the religious experience. I'm going to have a big fight with my best friend over this. And so between the time I was 15 and 27 or so, I think I only davened before the Amud once, when I got dragged into something in camp and I couldn't say no. So on the one hand, I could say, I understand why it's important. On the other hand, there are other things that are more important. If you demand it, it doesn't seem... And that's a tension I live with a lot. On the other hand, you can say, look, I made a voluntary choice. Right? So, that's a conversation I have often. But so I can say, but this is not such a... Maybe this is... But it matters to him. But mattering to him, right, we're not... subjective rights, right, it matters to me. That's a bad way to decide law. Right? So maybe this is a bad case... But I'm interested in is the argument he's trying to make, I have a right to this religious experience? And then we can say, it's cool that you, an interesting posek, or an important posek, make that kind of argument. By the way, in this particular case, you were kind of driven by self-interest. And we're going to discount you on this case, because this is, right, what are you talking about? It's just an aliyah. And that's an okay ending as well. And you can also tell me at the end of this, you proved your point entirely about the Maaseh Pinyamin. And what it teaches us is that even great poskim, when they write about themselves, just lose it. Right? And they start making arguments that are completely outside the mainstream. Right? I'm frank, I have this one tshuva. I don't have anyone else who writes this way. Right? The reason that we teach this tshuva is because it's unique. Right? Yes, Mark?
Mm-hmm. Say, 51, that still has a great voice, and it's our,
And who knows, right? You know, whether if they were, you know, if we had, if the Beit HaMikdash were still standing, we might all of a sudden have a parade of tshuvot by 51-year-old Levim, explaining why that's not really what the Torah means. Yeah, right. Might well, all of a sudden, how could the Torah possibly have meant that? I don't know. Right? It doesn't happen to come up so much. Yes, yeah. Yeah. You know, I could connect it very much to recent events where, you know, where people being aged out of certain positions seems to have generated a great deal of backlash. Right? Right? So that, right? It's very, might very well be a, might very well be such an issue. Okay. And maybe we decide this right. Okay. So he says, therefore, I concluded in my heart, Amarti the Gemarti Bilibi, now he's channeling Kohelet. right? Chalila li mi lazov et derech etz hachayim. Right? I'm not going to leave Gan Eden. No matter what God tells me. Right? I'm going to stay on the roots of the tree of life. Umi lechoz banafeha. I'm going to tree hug. Right? Right? I'm grasping the branches of the, right? I'm grasping the branches of the tree of life. Because, why? Because, right, because a hafti zos hatuda mimei kedem kidmasa. Right, this is the destiny I have loved my earliest days. Its laws and its rituals, and even in my old age, I will not cast it off, and in it I will walk. Okay, and that's the ending of the introduction. The ending of the introduction is: if you follow standard halachic reasoning, the answer would be I can't get Naliyah, and that would be acknowledging that would be giving him the right to cast me out of Eden, and I'm just not gonna. That I can't deal with. So now he says, "Veftach bidvar halacha." So I will open the halachic discussion. Lirot al me'asali harav kacha, to find out why the Beit Yosef did this to me. Right? Al me'asali harav kacha. Right. Okay. And then we move into martial metaphors. He says, "Vinei asai inayach harim haramim givot olam." I will lift my eyes for the mighty hills, the heights of the world. I will go out to the aid of God against the Beit Yosef. Right? It's basically the Beit Yosef against God. That's what's going on here. Right? I will go out to the aid of God by Giborim. I don't know if he's foreshadowing that one of his sources is going to be a work called the Shiltei HaGiborim, like the Shields of Warriors. Ochicha ve'ercha devarai. Right, so I'm going to stand up and be the courageous warrior in debate. And he tells you, right, but before all else, I'm going to set out the words of the authors, each under his banner with demonstrations, as I have found them in their works, early and late. These forbidding and these permitting, and now we get the extreme. The asadrim ma'aracha mul ma'aracha. I will organize them rank against rank. There's going to be a battlefield. Right, he's playing Stratego, so to speak. Right, with Rabbi Chibot, he's going to organize. Right, he's going to organize his figures. And we talk Elishtei Amarachot, Tistayim Shmaitas of Yisrael and Din Emet Bizrat Hashem. With Kiva Asader Tzibor Hashem. Pardon? Yeah, this is well. You know, it's a whole. Yeah, it's very much. It's very much. And you know, I wonder if Rabbi didn't have this Chibot before his eyes the whole time. Those of you don't know Rav Avadya Yosef, Alav Shalom, who also had great difficulty seeing. So in all his tshuvot, all the metaphors are visual. Right? And then my eyes saw, I went back and I saw every all the metaphors, all his tshuvot are visual, and I think that's very much on purpose. Okay. So he starts, right, so the first source he quotes is the Rush. And the Rush in Chapter 3 writes about the question. He acknowledges the reality, right? The original reality is that having an aliyah meant that you called somebody up and that person read the section. It didn't involve brachot. The person who read the first aliyah and the last aliyah, the person who read the first aliyah would make the first bracha, and the person who read the last aliyah would make the last bracha. At some point they established that everyone should make both brachot, and then at some point in the early Middle Ages, probably there is a shift towards having an official reader, and the people who are called up only make the bracha, but they're not the official reader. But there's a lot of tension trying to figure out what does this mean to have one person doing the reading and another person making the bracha. Why? What sense does that make? And all sorts of attempts to resolve this. One of them is to say that the person who gets the Aliyah should read along quietly next to the Balkare. Probably if you're a Balkari, you know that often drives you mad because A, people don't read quietly enough not to distract you, B, they may not be musical, C, they make mistakes. Right? So that's a really bad solution, albeit one that is a very reasonable technical halachic solution. And there are other ways to try and resolve this. So the Rush tries to make an argument of this sort, and the Rush ends up saying that if you look at the paragraph rather, he says, rather it seems to me that the reason that they generated this idea of having the official Torah reader was that not everyone knows the cantillation, and therefore the congregation does not fulfill its obligation through his reading. They're calling out people for aliyot, and it doesn't work because people make mistakes. And the people, but in his own eyes, he does know how. But these people think they do know. And if you don't give them an aliyah, guess what? If you don't give people aliyot, they start fights. What, you think I can't read? So everyone thinks aliyot are important. Right? So if you don't give people an aliyot, and you say, I'm sorry, we can't give an aliyah because you're a terrible Balkari. Right? So they're going to start fighting the Shliach Tzibur and come up themselves, instead of letting the Shliach Tzibur do it. So that's why the Rush says, in the end, they legislated that the Shliach Tzibur should read being expert. But nonetheless, the Rush says, the one being called up to read should read quietly and with precision along with the Shliach Tzibur so that his blessing would not be in vain. Okay, so the Rush says that's the right solution. The Balkari reads out loud, the other person reads quietly. As many people point out, what sense does that make at all, right? What is the bracha related to? The private reading or the public reading? That's the way the Rush ends up with it. And then the Rush says, but someone who cannot read, it is inappropriate to have the Shliach Tzibur dictate to him, and his blessing is in vain, as it does not seem to be reasonable to say that his blessing relates to the reading of the Shliach Tzibur. Right? So the Rush says that the blessing has to relate to the reading of the Torah, and so there are two people who can't do that. You can't do it if you're illiterate, and you can't do it if you're blind. And that seems like a straightforward thing, right? If you can't read, you can't get an aliyah, even if you're no longer the one doing the public reading. But in order to make the bracha, you have to be a reader. That's the position of the Rush. The Menuchah Yosef, in the name of the Eshkol, also cited by the Beit Yosef, quotes an interesting story, which he says, in the name of the Eshkol, this is a complicated thing, whether the Eshkol really says this. The Eshkol really exists in multiple versions. One of them may be a forgery. There's all sorts of fun things about what the text actually is. Let's assume for now the Beit Yosef, right, that the Beit Yosef text is accurate. He didn't have the forgery. Yes.
So, I'm just wondering, if any of the people knew of something like Braille, would this negate their arguments or not?
Let's assume you have to read our Torah, and so there is, right, it's an interesting question which we raised last year, what happens if you, Braille wouldn't be a kosher Sefer Torah, whether you could have a Sefer Torah with raised ink, and if somebody read it with its, right, does reading require visual processing as opposed to tactile processing? Nobody raised that there, right? We talked about last year that, Danny Nevins, who's the dean of JTS, talked about there is a machine that converts light and dark into tactile experiences. And so he was suggesting that you might be able to do Kriyat HaTorah for blind people, right, using such a machine, but it turns out it was too expensive to be practical at the time, and also it has Shabbos issues, so it was mostly a thought experiment. He doesn't use it either, although I think when I talked to him a couple of months ago, and I think he still thought it was impractical.
I mean, raised ink sounds...
Yeah, Shal Shabbos has its own issues, but maybe you can use it with the kosher switch,
no,
right?
No, I meant the raising.
Why is the raising in the
Sefer Torah?
So you're touching a Sefer Torah. Wear gloves.
Is it Mamash in a Beira?
You're touching the ink, you won't be touching the
cloth. You know, sometimes, okay, right, I was telling the story of my boy, that one of the first questions I got was whether you could convert the child of an intermarried couple, the mother was not Jewish, but where they had older children, all the older children were Orthodox, and the rabbi of a particular synagogue had been converting the kids as they were born for many years. The wife wouldn't convert because she was too honest to Right? She loved Judaism, she loved Orthodoxy, but she wasn't sure she believed it. So she was too honest to convert. But she was very supportive of the kids being Jewish. The question was, could you convert them or not? And I went to Rabbi Bleich, and I said, the question is it a benefit to the kids to convert them? And he said to me, no, because the children are eating basar shnit alei min ha'ayin. Right, because when the mother's home, right, there's the meat in the fridge, and the meat doesn't have any certificate, right, isn't under Jewish supervision the entire time. So even though they're eating glatt kosher, and they're keeping tariag mitzvah, the mother's really supportive, but it's still not as good because they're eating basar shnit alei min ha'ayin. So I looked at him, and I said, they're vegetarians. Now answer the question. Right, so sometimes, you have a technical halachic solution. That's not the right, it's not the right question. We'll find a way to solve the technical halachic. The technical halachic problem. There's a way around that. Yes,
What if you had transparent sheets?
Yeah, okay, there are lots of ways to solve it, right?
Like print on
the... Yeah, there are lots of ways to solve it. If it's a technical problem, we'll find a way to solve it, okay? Right, we'll have... whatever. All right, we'll find a way to solve it. Yes?
There's maybe a left field, but can one argue that it's not Kavanat Tzibur to have a blind person...
Or vice versa.
But it's not Kavodah.
Right, this is where Rabbi Lau always reverts, right? What it'll create the impression that Art Sieber doesn't treat the disabled with full equality. That would diminish the dignity of the Sieber, right? So that argument is always reversible.
Sometimes,
so,
reversible.
I mean, so
not always.
In a weird way, that's the right word for females to
take a little stronger. And it goes both ways. Yes, people keep trying to reverse the arguments that way. And Aliyot and Kvod HaBriyot have their own history, where in some cases yes, in some cases no, and trying to play that out. The answer where we say yes is colostomies. People whose intestines no longer end in places where they can excrete themselves. So they have bags, and normally if you have excrement anywhere near, you can't go near a Sefer Torah. But yet the standard psak is that people with colostomies can get Aliyot.
Wasn't that based on the fact that Kain is called to Maliyah, is Tamei, we still accept him?
I don't think so.
For Kohen, it's what?
I don't think so. I don't think so. Okay, so I want to read the... Hamik Yosef quotes the Eshkol, and the Eshkol says as follows. That which we learned in the Mishnah Perek to Megillah Omed, that a Summa cannot be read the Torah. By the way, obviously it would be dispositive if there were a Mishnah that said a Summa can't read the Torah, but it turns out that there are different editions of the Mishnah, some of which say have that line and some of which don't. We don't have to go there now.
What?
Yes.
Shouldn't there have been the first thing that you mentioned?
No, because that's only if we're interested in the halachic outcome, only interested in the arguments he made. Okay, so the Sefer Eshkol quotes that Mishnah, but he says that, watch what he does. He has that Mishnah, which says Asuma can't read the Torah. And he says, Hainu Lomar, what that means is she'eno korei be'al peh. That means he cannot read from memory. Aval ukme inish achrina, but having another person stand up there, shepoteach, right, who opens viro'eh and sees, v'hasuma mivarech ve'omeid b'tzido, and the blind person makes the blessing and stands next to him, shapir dami. That's okay. All right, we're going to take this text. I'm warning you that there's another text where it's not clear who the person making the blessing is, and the other, right, so there's another version, and maybe that all you did with the Summa was just have him stand there and do nothing at all. But this version of the text says that, hold on one second. Right, this version of the text says that according to the Eshkol, that even though the Mishnah says a Summa cannot read the Torah, but it's okay to have a blind person get up and make the bracha while somebody else reads the Torah. And his last line is, V'hachi matzi avid chatan suma. And we can do that at your afruf. If there's a blind person getting married, at their afruf, right, you can give them an aliyah at their afruf. And that's the argument vice versa, that there seems to have been a tradition which began in a particular case where they're trying to find something for the, right, something for the blind, and something for a blind groom, and so he comes up with this argument, now that we have Balei Kriya, even though the Mishnah said they can't read Torah, but why should reading be necessary? Right, so as opposed to the Rush who says it's impossible to separate the blessing and the reading, he says, why can't you have the blessing and the reading separate? One person makes the blessing, one person does the reading, what's the big deal? Okay, yes, Dan. So the blind person can't read from memory, right? But he doesn't have to read.
He's not allowed to read.
Right. He's not allowed to read from memory, but he doesn't have to read. He can just make the blessing. So you have these two opposing positions. One position says, according to the Rush, says that you have to read. The Nehuke Yosef quotes the Eshkol as saying you don't have to read, and that's the halachic argument. There's an intermediate position which says that you're not allowed to read from memory, but you can read from dictation. So if the Balkore recites it, and you read it immediately after the Balkore, so your reading is sufficiently connected to the text to be considered reading. Right, that would be a second way in which you could generate the claim that a blind person can get an aliyah and read, as long as somebody else is there to dictate from a text to them, so that their reading is not from memory, right? But it has a direct connection to the text. Yes. Very good question. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer at all. It spreads from that source. It spreads about weddings, but then by the time you get several centuries later, they're doing it for Talmidei Chachamim, and it keeps on expanding. In Ashkenaz, at least, it's clear that by some point several centuries ago, the standard halakha was that blind people got aliyot regardless. Now, part of this is that what happens is that ignoramuses start getting aliyot regardless, and people start looking at it and saying, if you're giving that ignoramus an aliyah, how can you not give that blind Talmid Chacham an aliyah? Since the logic is dependent. Illiterate, person who can't read, right? A person who could not do the Kriya.
Do we have other examples of a time where do we have a different halakha for Chatan?
Not so much, that I know of.
So we don't really know?
Nope. Don't really know. Sort of, yeah, very sort of.
Is that why? No, I'm saying, is there?
Everyone accepts the Magen Avraham's list from where we got it from, Mario or something.
I think that's after these arguments anyway. I think.
No, it's posted pretty early. They're going
to
be.
Okay, you want to do it that way? It's okay with me. Okay, so now, then the Maaseh Binyamin, right? And we're cutting the argument short. He says, you know what? In order to win an argument, halachically, you got to do it one of three ways. You have to bring proof, or you have to have a majority, or you have to have the latest authorities, and he claims that he wins on all three grounds, that even though the Beit Yosef said that the halacha is this way, the Beit Yosef is completely wrong, because he missed some sources, he misinterpreted some sources, and then he goes to town and claims that the Beit Yosef is wrong when he thinks that the Zohar doesn't beat everything, and he thinks the Zohar beats everything. And he thinks the Zohar lets blind people get aliyot. Right, so that's right. So he just sort of drives straight through the Beis Yosef's argument and just ends up dismissing him out of hand. Just says he's just wrong. So the question we have to evaluate is: to what extent do we think does he really mean that, or to what extent is it that he's making a his empathetic argument, so to speak, is not powerful enough, so he needs technical arguments. This is parallel to the dispute about the Sridei Eish of Yechiel Weinberg, who has a tshuva about whether women can sing Zmirot or not, and he brings seven reasons that women can sing Zmirot at the Shabbat table. Six of them are technical halachic reasons, and the seventh one is Eit Lasot L'Hashem Eferu Torotecha. Right, it's a time to act for God, and sometimes you have to suspend the halacha, because otherwise people will stop being frum. So the question is, does he really mean the technical arguments, but there's some people who won't, if people won't agree with his technical arguments, he says, and by the way, you have to do this anyway because it's necessary for a policy perspective? Or is it he really thinks that it's necessary from a policy perspective, but he thinks that some people won't grant his authority? So for those people who won't accept his authority, he has to give them technical arguments so they can cover themselves, that they're following his arguments and not his authority. Very hard to figure out with tshuva. I tend to think that he believes the technical arguments because there's another thing where you can discover that what it is he came to Germany, he discovered this was common practice, and it wasn't what he was used to, but he discovered that it had been the standard practice going back, at least to Rabbi Hildesheimer, that women sang Zmirot at the Shabbat table, and he decided that had enough traditional basis to go for it. But then he was writing for an Eastern European audience, so just saying that it's a Western European custom wasn't going to work. Okay, so now we get to the last page. So he says, Yesh mentioned earlier, Tosafot Rosh Hashanah write explicitly about the statement in Pesachim chapter 10 that a blind person is exempt from reciting the Haggadah, and the Talmud challenges from the story of Rosh Hashanah and Rav Yosef, who were both blind. who said Haggadah in their house and thereby fulfilled others' obligations vicariously. And Tosfos says, aha! So you see, they're exempt from Haggadah, and they said it, and they said it for others. So that seems to that Tosfos demonstrates that you can make a bracha even if you are not obligated. This is Tosfos' whole proof that women can make brachot on mitzvot as seishah as man grama. And the Maaseh Binyamin ends up making the claim that you can make brachot for any purpose you want. There's never any issue of bracha levatala as long as you have a religious purpose when you make a bracha. And he basically eliminates the whole notion of bracha levatala in real terms, which is a really interesting notion in its own right. Okay, I want to get to the last paragraph. He says, I am further astounded regarding those who forbid. O tmihani al divrei ha'osrim. Deheach echlitu hadin, how did they decide the law? Lefrok ol malchut shemayim me'al hanashim, to remove the yoke of heaven from people. That's what he thinks the psak, right, the psak was, right? Telling you, remove it, yes, okay, maybe it's a little over the top, right? O bifrat mitzvah rabab mefursemet kazu. Especially a great and prominent mitzvah such as this. So Aliyot have all of a sudden become the equivalent of denying people the yoke of heaven and removing them from the right from that claim. This is not what we have learned from a master's of blessed memory. And here he goes back to gender. The sages of the Mishnah of the Talmud, as in fact they said that Michal bat Shaul could wear tefillin, and they did not object. And Yonah's wife went Aliyah l'regel, and right, and brought the olat riyah. And furthermore, right, that we let women do quasi smicha. Right, in order to make the women feel better about it, which is its own separate halachic category. Smicha and korbanot. Yes, leaning on korbanot. Right, that's always the classic. Right, the classic joke of the Gemara is whether smicha. Right, the line of the Gemara is whether nashim somchot reshut, but it doesn't. Right, with smicha in terms of putting your hands on public sacrifices, rather than whether you can lean fully or not. But that you know, they seem to have been made for later jokes. Okay. Right, so he goes, right, he quotes all those sources, about Tosfot, which suggest that women can do mitzvot aseisha as man grama. And he says, accordingly, it is also true in our case that we should waive the rule for the ignoramus and the blind, and not object to them receiving aliyot and making the blessing, so that they will be included within the acceptance of the yoke of heaven, and to give them religious satisfaction. Lasot nachat ruach.
Uh-huh. You're injecting again. Because in the Hebrew it says just nachat ruach.
Nachat ruach.
And to say that that's religious.
Ah, okay.
That's
so
your
good. There is a, you can read a.
Just as easily understand it. If they would feel bitter if they were excluded. And so latet lehem nachat ruach.
So you want me to put religious in parentheses. Okay. Okay. Yes, so.
Understand the mechanism at play with Michal or Yonah's wife.
So the mechanism, as he understands it, is people want to do mitzvot. Why would you stop them?
No.
But at the same time, he's not okay. He's all right. He's used having it both ways because he's saying, "Look, people can do mitzvot. Why would you stop them?" But then he also, right? But so he thinks that it's a right to engage in the experience. He's not talking about the construction of the obligation, right? Because those are all cases where you can do them despite being obligated. And he really makes two different arguments. One is that there still is an obligation, and the other is that even if there's no obligation, why would you stop someone from making brachot? Okay, then he ends with something, again, we have to figure out how aware of irony is, because what parsha does he write this in? Kicha lo ayda kulam kedoshim. Parsha Korach. Right, he signs it, the parsha of Korach's argument, right? After all, everybody should be a Kohen against the servant of the Beit HaMikdash. So I hope that he has some sense of irony. Right, when he signs the tshuva like this, by quoting Korach.
It's
Karti
Rosh. People who don't understand the context
realize everyone's holy. Yes. Yeah. So it's difficult. I remember at my high school graduation, my school was terrified that I would give it to our Torah. I'm kichol hoyda kulam kedoshim and endorse it. So, all right. So there you are. Right, this is the way he frames the argument. Now, my reading of the argument is that this is about a right to religious experience. Rabbi Linzer says it has nothing to do with religious experience, it's all about inclusion. Right, how can you not let the disabled be full members of the community, as opposed to how can you not let somebody with a particular disability continue having a particular religious experience? And that's a fundamental argument, because from my perspective, this Right, this is irrelevant to social inclusion questions, and you need different sources for that. This is right totally a question of psak, and whether you have an obligation to decide the halakha in such a way. And where it came up last year was my argument was that you have a religious tradition. Right, you have the Mishnah, which is really pretty clear that people who are deaf and non-speaking are not chayav and mitzvot at all. They're considered legally the equivalent of the feeble-minded, and then you have a reality that we suddenly discover they're not. And so you have some people who want to argue, okay, so we don't really know how to square the halakha, which says they're like the feeble-minded, with the reality. So we'll say, oh, there's halakha l'moshe misinai, that even though they're not feeble-minded, we treat them as if they are feeble-minded. And my argument was, no, you can't paskin in such a way that, right, that these people who are fully competent Jews are not capable of having the experience of being obligated. Right, that way, right, it's not a question of social inclusion. It's a question of right, of the right to the experience of being obligated. So I read this as being about halakha and the right to religious experience. And again, that has extensions beyond where Rabbi Linzer goes, and it doesn't go as far as Rabbi Linzer goes in other places. I'm not convinced that he has any interest in social inclusion at all. But I can't prove that. Okay, three comments, and then we should probably send everyone home. Yes, Avi.
One thing, which is really two things. It seems like you can square yourself with Rabbi Linzer by saying, going back to the original point, rights and duties being flip sides of one another.
Yes.
What you call the right of a person to be included, he calls the obligation.
I don't call the right of a person to be included. I call the right of a person to
have the religious experience of obligation. He calls the obligation of the posse to include them. Now, you can then say the second thing, which is that obviously they're not the flip side, and you found the proof that there are rights whose attendant obligations don't square. Because he says, essentially, if you accept the first point, that he says basically the flip of what you say, which is then the same thing, he goes to a different place because he's talking about inclusion, and you're really talking about a specific person having the right to religious experience.
Yeah, no, we've had this discussion, and he really thinks it's all about how the person feels in relation to other people. And I am only interested in how in how the person relates to God. Right? And it so happens that people's relationship to God is mediated by the halachic decisions made by people. But ultimately, I think it's a
question of whether we're Spock or not.
I don't know that, you know. Well, normally, I think that Star Trek is always relevant. I'm not sure that I see the immediate. That I would quote a different note. Okay. Yes, Avino.
I guess I would say that just for the purposes of your rhetoric, I think you might be falling into a similar thing where your own personal desire to use the word religious experience, I can get into the personal that you read it personally as opposed to socially. I just think it's very dangerous to use a term like religious, which did not exist in Hebrew, and even the word dot doesn't really mean religion,
okay, so,
and to use the word experience, which didn't exist in Hebrew either until relatively recently.
Okay, so it's the right to have every possible manifestation of the experience of Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim.
Which I don't know why you use the word experience.
So I didn't. I removed it. It's the right to have every possible manifest. It's right to have as full Kabbalat Ol Malchut Shemayim as possible.
Okay.
If that works for you, that's fine.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Granted. Yes, Jenna.
I'm just not sure that even phrasing it like that, I actually didn't have a problem with religious experience, but even phrasing it like that, I don't think it gets you off the hook of it being partly social, because my feeling of a lack of something because I do not have an obligation is inherently defined by other people having that obligation. Like, if I didn't see other people having an obligation, I wouldn't care that I didn't have that. And especially in Judaism, where it's all, religious experience, obligation is all so mixed up in how we interact communally. I think it's pushing it to say that it's just about the person and God.
So I guess I would try and argue, maybe naively, this maybe Spockishly, that there's a difference between saying someone else has that something and I understand what it is. If he didn't have it, I wouldn't know what it was. But now that I've seen what he has, wow, right? That is something that I really feel that I would be I would be a deeper person, whatever it would be, right, if I had it, and saying, well, if he has it, why can't I have it? Right, the second argument doesn't impress me. Right? If people want a religious experience because someone else has it and they feel unequal because the other person has it, I guess that's the ground. Rabbi Linzer would say, wow, that's a really good point. And, you know, and I would say, and where it comes down to is Korach, right? And it's really the test it comes down to is, should I feel that way about Kohanim? Right? That's really where it comes down to that way, right? Kohanim have an experience. And suppose I really got what Birkat Kohanim was. Right? Would I be entitled to say that's right, that's the case? Or am I not entitled to say that, right? So they have that experience. I don't have that experience. No big deal. I think to make the argument powerful to me, you have to really want that experience for its own sake. And then the interesting question is, why did Korach want it?
Right, which I feel like is like why this is coming from. It has to be coming from him, in that he's experiencing the lack of a right to this obligation, right? Because once you have that obligation, you're looking at it from the perspective of, why would anyone want to be obligated in this? I'd get so much more out of it if I chose to do it, right? Which I think is an attitude that. I think it's an attitude that we have towards converts a lot of, like, there's, like, a kind of a, like, why would you want to convert to have to do all of this, right? Or, like, and I think possibly there's other people who are writing law for people who aren't obligated or something and, like, don't quite understand the meaning of the game.
Uh-huh. Right? So I would say, that one of my life philosophic projects is trying to come up with a rigorous philosophic argument about... Right, the difference when I was at Wexner, so the thing that was constantly the language barrier we couldn't get across was the word obligation and chiyuv. That for the halachically committed among us, so we won't use the denominational terms, for the halachically committed among us, obligation was an objective metaphysical state. Mm-hmm. And that there really was a difference, I felt at least. There was an enormous difference between saying I am obligated and I feel obligated. And when we had cross-denominational boundaries, we couldn't get that across, right? It would always break down into... People would give speeches about the importance of obligation in non-orthodoxy or a non-halachic obligation, and they could never get it past I feel obligated. Mm-hmm. And right, the notion of their being obligated just could never get across. So I have tried... I think somebody can write Parshas Tetzaveh. Almost every year, I write an essay in memory of Matt Eisenfeld, who was blown up in one of the Jerusalem bombings many years ago, because he had a long conversation with me that one of my friends sent him to me when he was at Yale about obligation and right and what really is that difference when he was trying to make a decision between JTS and the Orthodox world, and so I sort of try every year. Don't always get it done every year to revisit that question, an essay on what it means to be Parshas Tetzaveh, right? What it means to be doing something as to have the condition of being a mitzvah. Now I say this as somebody who has a deep philosophic commitment to autonomy, and a lot of my other work is about trying to generate notions for legitimacy of autonomy within halakha. I guess in a sense you could say, right? Rav Lichtenstein said that Ayn Rand was unsalvageable because all of Ayn Rand's work was attempting to undermine the notion of a mitzvah-mitzvah relationship. And Rosenzweig said he thinks Ayn Rand is salvageable, and I take that position, that there really is a tremendous value in doing things autonomously as opposed to heteronomously. But I think that an essential part of halakha is the notion that there is something about the experience of heteronomy. What happens at Sinai, right, is you become the chuyav. So there has to be something...
That's the simple answer to your question.
Yeah.
Right? That there is a legal framework where you have come into an agreement that obligates you to do something. So you could ask your friend Wexler, well, do you feel obligated to pay your mortgage?
So you want to generate a covenant theology, right? Where the obligation is generated by your agreement with God, as opposed to something that happens to you. That's that movement, right? That's what chiyuv is, right? Chiyuv is you're participating in a contractual relationship of some sort. So there are whole sorts of theology that way. And that's a great question. I'm not mostly a covenant theologian, so I'm less interested in the reciprocity of the nature of obligation. And it's part of the whole challenge. We tend to think of covenants as parties, as arrangements among equals, right? Archaeologically, right, the Ten Commandments are a Hittite vassal treaty, right? So, right, so you can set it up that way that there's...
You don't need to be an archaeologist to recognize that this was not an agreement among equals.
Yeah, so that's, I think that it's a powerful point. I'm not sure that in the end I'm as contractual as you are, but it's certainly a legitimate way to go, to claim that the obligation is generated by the contractual obligation. I tried. I tried all the versions. I tried the Karate Kid version, right, where you know where obligation is a function of mentorship. Right, you know, wax on, wax off. You just have to write it. I tried a couple of different ones. We can have that conversation on an ongoing basis. I've been writing this essay for 20 something years now, and I still don't have a formulation that makes me happy. And usually, you know, the reaction from the audience is I've gone backwards since the first time. First time I gave it, that my new attempts don't work as well as the old ones. All right, it's 10:15, and no one will come back if I don't end it now. So you want to come up and talk to me afterwards, that's great, but we're going to end the formal session. Thank you very much for coming.
You're in a red lens, or is that like...